All right, welcome to After the Collapse. This is a show looking into the link between economic exploitation and social injustice. Today, our guest is Steve De Silva. And Steve is one of the founders of Basics Community News Service, a former editor with the media organization for 3 years. He continues to serve as a people's journalist with the organization in Toronto, where he spent most of his life. De Silva also represents the organization in one of the alliances it participates in, which is the Canadian chapter of the International League of People's Struggles, where he is serving an 18-month term as its vice chairperson. He is also doing a doctorate in political economy at York University, and he's also a new father to little Rosa Lila.
Layla, right? Yes.
Layla.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Thanks for having me on the show, guys.
No problem. Thanks for being here. So we'll just jump right in. You work with Basic News. So what led to your work with Basic News?
Well, I came in pretty close to the beginning. And what became Basics Community News Service was not what we thought we were creating when we initially deployed. The newspaper itself came about initially as an instrument, a tool, in our community organizing work, where we felt we needed some kind of, quite frankly, propaganda. We needed something to propagate analysis and information about what was happening in working class communities. Initially, it was the issue of gentrification and housing concerns, particularly lack of maintenance in Toronto community housing.
And to a specific area of Toronto.
Yeah, initially the first two, three issues of the paper, which was on 8.5 by 11, folded over, printed off at somebody's workplace, kind of secretly, clandestinely. I think our first few issues went out in Lawrence Heights, Regent Park, and Parkdale, if I'm not mistaken. And then we kind of consolidated in and around Lawrence Heights with the planned revitalization scheme that they were looking to develop in the community. And some of our people had been, in and around the redevelopment project in Regent Park. And we had seen what had happened there is that, people were not necessarily informed or misled as to what the process would look like, the introduction of private housing into, these mixed housing schemes. And we wanted to bring some of that experience to Lawrence Heights, and we really needed a newspaper to do that. Initially, the project was aimed at organizing people, organizing tenants into a mass formation that people ran and people controlled, that was independent from the powers that be, whether it's the landlord or the agencies, which are notorious for depoliticizing people's struggles in their communities. So we were very much interested in tenant organizing, but the more we, the more issues we printed, the more we came to realize that the media project itself was becoming something unto itself, and it was very important that we nurture it and give it the attention and resources that it needed, because people were hungry for that information, that analysis, which is issues that are scantily reported, or if they are reported, they're distorted in the corporate media. So particularly with the issue of police brutality intensifying in the city, and when we had printed and written stories around those issues, particularly around one incident with the death of Alwi Al-Nadir in 2007, just outside of Regent Park when he was shot down by police. When we printed a couple issues around his death and working with the family and developing a campaign, the Justice Rowey campaign with the family, the paper really took off. And that's when we realized that we needed to develop a people's media apparatus.
Between starting your paper and getting to that point, how many people were actually involved?
The paper started with a handful, maybe 4 or 5. I came in around the time of Lawrence Heights. And by the time we got to the Justice Rowey campaign, our organization probably had about 20 people, 20 full dues-paying members. That's how we fund ourselves. We're an entirely self-funded organization, which relies mostly on membership dues and a little bit of fundraising here or there.
What kind of people?
Regular, I don't know, mostly young people. I find that it's been younger people who have been interested in the media aspect of the work. We work with, the people's organizations, the community organizations we're working with have people of all ages and backgrounds, However, the paper itself, the media organization, tends to attract, I guess, younger people who are a bit more media savvy, are interested in developing media skills. So we've always struggled with that. We've always wanted to diversify the range of people involved. But nonetheless, you know, a young membership makes for a very dynamic membership. So it's tended to be high school students, university students, just young people in general who get involved with the paper. And, you know, we don't assume people coming into the organization have BAs or are doing BAs in journalism. We have struggled to develop the skills training workshops in order to provide people with the basic skills they need to be able to write, produce, interview, you know, and most importantly, distribute the media through communities, whether it's door-to-door distribution with the newspaper, radio production, and now we're just getting into videography and photography as well.
So from newspaper, like hand mm-hmm. typed newspaper, yeah. printed out newspaper, you now, can you just list off what
the... Yeah, we have the print, we have basicsnews.ca, we have the radio show, Radio Basics on CHRY 105.5, and we're just now developing our capacity in photography and videography. So we've made a couple short videos, some broadcast pieces, some more documentary pieces, you know, very amateur, but the content, I think, is... the content carries the, you know, the form is, you know, we can apologize for the form on the basis of the content, which really, I think... we'll get better, and then photography as well.
So, and do you have a sense or a metrics to know how many people you're actually reaching now compared to, other than like the World Wide Web?
I guess tracking through, just seeing the hits and page views on the site is one thing. You know, the newspaper itself, we've right from the beginning when we began actually printing on newsprint, which is from issue 4. When we consolidated work in Lawrence Heights, we were running 2,000 copies an issue, focused exclusively on the community. And then when we expanded into Regent Park with the death of Alwi, the murder of Alwi, we jumped up to 5,000. And at times we've jumped up to 10,000 or 12,000 an issue. But our ability to, you know, actually put out that many papers is really dictated by the membership and basis that we have throughout communities. So because 12,000 papers means that 12, you know, those have to be delivered door to door, those have to be delivered directly to people, which is the way we've tended to operate. We don't really just leave stacks to collect dust in businesses or you know, community centers, which we do that as well, but I think about 60-70% of our papers go directly to people door to door.
So maybe just to get a more concrete sense of the kind of work Basics does, can you give us a couple of examples of the kinds of stories that either you cover that are not covered in the mainstream media, or the kinds of coverage you give stories people may have read about in the mainstream media?
I think what's in developing this people's media apparatus, I think we've come to realize that at least for the near future, we're not trying to replace the corporate media. You know, we obviously can't be everywhere at once. We can't be covering every issue. You know, every time a politician passes gas, we can't be covering that story, right? We have to actually focus on, given our limited resources, we have to focus on feature analyses and in-depth investigation of people's struggles and people's issues in our communities. And I think that's what's helped the paper develop over time, is that we actually are telling stories that are just not coming through the mainstream media. You know, for no particular reason, other than the fact that it's a very prominent issue in the city, the issue of police brutality, if you read through our issues, has been prominent in almost every local section of the paper. And not because we necessarily go searching for those stories, but those stories come to us because people know that we'll actually carry them. So often it's stories that are written directly by individuals who have faced police brutality or, you know, police terror in their neighborhoods. And for every story that we get in, we also know that there's, you know, 10, 20, 100 stories that are not being told because of the fear and intimidation that people feel in their communities when it comes to police violence. So those are some examples. For instance, you know, when Junior Manon was killed near Jane Finch, actually on New York University campus, we covered that story immediately. We got in touch with the family. We knew people in the community who knew the family, and we got in touch. We found out what really happened that day. As some may remember, when Junior was killed, what was reported in the media is that he died of a heart attack running away from the police. And he was running from the police. He got out of his car and he ran away, and they chased him down. They beat him to death. What was reported in the media is that he died of a heart attack. We reported on that story the same night, and within 24 hours, I think our website got 40,000 hits, because we were the only media outlet that had actually reported what really happened that night. So people were seeing the ticker saying that, oh, boy dies of a heart attack. You know, you see it on CP24 in the subway or, you know, in a cafe, and you just kind of, you don't think twice about it. That's it, right? City of 3 million people, somebody dies of a heart attack, big deal. When people saw what we had reported, it went viral immediately. And that's, I think, probably the biggest story that we've written in terms of something that's gone viral. So there's stuff that is distorted in the media or just not reported. I guess in terms of range of issues that we're covering, whether it's, issues facing working class people in our communities or in their workplaces, or whether it's giving an analysis to events and developments happening around the world, that if we are hearing about them in the media, we're getting an extremely skewed understanding of what's happening, or in some cases we're hearing absolutely nothing at all.
And why do you believe that's the case?
Well, I mean, if we talk about, you know, our country's role in, you know, our country's position in the global economy, as something that as what I would call an imperialist country, you know, an economy that relies heavily on the import of labor, on the exploits, you know, the exploitation of workers here and abroad, the reliance on resources coming from all around the world, whether it's through Canada's mining companies or other corporations operating abroad. The what we get in the media about developments happening around the world are often narratives of that are not to a great extent in contradiction with Canada's foreign policy. So although we do hear stuff about, you know, maybe the war in Afghanistan or developments taking place in the Middle East right now or other places where Canada has troops or has interests, you know, it often comes to us distorted.
With regard to your work with Basics and mainstream media, what is your relationship, if anything, with the mainstream media?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, we haven't, because we've intensely been trying to develop our organization, we have not done very much to try to engage journalists who we know, you know, are probably on the same kind of tip that we are, probably would resonate with a lot of the stuff that we're doing. And we know there's a lot of critical journalists in the city, many journalists who I respect who work for the Toronto Star, write for Now regularly. Our relationship to the mainstream media has been rather inexistent, I guess, up to this point. I mean, there's a couple journalists here or there that we've talked to, but we have done not too much. We have, however, worked with other media organizations that are, you know, so-called independent or community-based or alternative or more radical. You know, we have a great relationship with the Media Co-op, which is different sections of Media Co-op exist across the country, and they work closely with the Dominion paper, and also CHRY, which is where we have our regular weekly radio program. We have a great relationship with them. And, you know, there's tremendous possibilities for collaboration amongst other community media organizations, people's media organizations, and independent and alternative media organizations. And we've done a lot to tap those sorts of possibilities.
And you've been focusing a lot with Basics News on educating young people on how to do the craft of journalism. And how? Why do you feel that's important?
We feel that's important because a lot of the, and some of the most important stories that we've produced have been those that have reached deep into communities and have actually have a degree of social investigation that I think it's not that a lot of journalists are not capable of producing, but, you know, being under, working under the clock and also having certain editorial positions or orientations are just not able to come out with. We believe that it's important to be working with people to produce journalism that's relevant to people.
Traditionally, the idea of media is that they are getting past that, that they are actually investigating into stories. And not that you have the answer, but why, again, like, why do you think that is? Why do you think it is that these, that the stories come out the way they do when theoretically the media is there to dig deeper?
Well, we know that the media is not a neutral entity in relation to, you know, some of the issues that you prefaced the beginning of the show with, that, you know, that we live in this world of exploitation and social inequalities, and the media is not a neutral arbiter in relation to those conflicts and those inequalities. What we call the you know, what generally we think of when we think of the media are these large corporate entities that are not merely, like, their principal responsibility is actually not to produce what I guess in this a liberal outlook on the world likes to view as objective and neutral content. How can that be the case when the primary fiduciary responsibility of any corporation, let alone a media corporation, is to produce for profit? And when their profit motives come into conflict with what they're reporting on, then, you know, I think often what we see is distortions. Another, you know, a whole aspect of the world, events and developments taking place throughout the world that are completely ignored altogether, is people fighting for liberation and freedom. We think that these are the stories that are wholly lacking in the corporate media. So, you know, often the view that we get of the world is that, which reinforces this, you know, idea that a lot of Canadians have, especially new Canadians, that, you know, we're just glad to be here. This is the best country in the world. Is that there is this hellish world outside the borders of Canada or outside the West. And, you know, we're all just glad to be here. And often, to a certain extent, given the exploitation and the conditions that the proverbial self or the periphery of the world system is forced to live in, of course, many people would take the opportunity to come to a country like Canada, where the level of security and, you know, the ability to survive is perhaps somewhat greater. However, when it comes to people fighting for a better world, people trying to make a better situation out of their out of increasingly desperate and unjust circumstances, we hear very little about the circumstances. We hear very little about people fighting for freedom and liberation. And when we do, it's a very selective set of experiences or examples or narratives that we're getting, whether it's even, you know, the reporting that's occurred in relation to the so-called Arab Spring in the last couple of years, right? When the Egyptian masses were rising up to get rid of this, Western-backed dictator, Mubarak, you had Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama telling the Egyptian people not to take up arms, that peaceful protest was the only way to democracy. Yet, just months later, we have the West funneling weapons into Libya and then later into Syria to help produce democracy, right? Entirely hypocritical. I mean, aside from that, our political leaders here are speaking out of both sides of their mouths. We see from those two examples that imperialism has no qualms against arming people in order to effect regime change when it's convenient for them. Yet when it comes to democratic movements, as the ones that we saw in Egypt, you know, the West was quite fearful of what may come about if the Egyptian masses remove the dictator by their own means, by mass struggle, perhaps even by armed struggle. And there are many examples in the world where people are fighting for freedom and liberation, which maybe we'll perhaps get to a little bit later in the show if we talk about some of Basic's international affiliations or alliance work, where there are people who have been fighting for liberation and freedom for quite some time, and there's a complete media blackout on their struggles for justice and emancipation.
Well, on that note, let's go to our first song that you've chosen.
Eye for an Eye, yeah. Well, this track is off a new mixtape that has been put together by some artists that we work with here in Toronto, an artist by the name of Comrade, who's working with rappers from the Tamil community and also from Six Nations. The mixtape is called Land Defenders for Life, and this track, Eye for Eye, I'm sure some people will recognize, speaking to a lot of issues, particularly in the wake of the shootings here in Toronto, particularly in the Danzig, on Danzig Avenue. So check it out, and I'm sure it'll resonate with a lot of people.
Year up the gun when T-Dot was live. What must be done? Hit the streets while sun arrived. 7 years ago, track seven, read between the lines. Urban guerrillas said blacks were in decline. Wait a few years till the city get poorer and summers get colder. On the block, more soldiers and more stuck in a cell till they get older. 2012 T-Dot filled with more foreigners, less job opportunities for the corner kids. Summer of the gun, year two, ask the coroner. Murders are down, shootings broke the thermometer. While the Eaton Center food court still haunted us. 25 shot at Galloway, what the trauma does. 95 Raekwon made a hit in a song for us. Verbal intercourse, not spit, wisdom onto us. Cycle, niggas come home, some will go in. Do a bullet, come back, and do the same shit again. This been going on for years, the same shit. Shit never ends, so we holding up beers. Pour some for fallen men. Try holding back tears, but you can't swallow them. As time goes by, an eye for an eye. We in this together, so your struggle's mine. As long as Amina grows to age 25, get communist training on how to organize. As time goes by, an eye for an eye. We in this together, so your struggle's mine. As long as Amina grows to age 25, get communist training on how to organize. Nowadays the left moving right like Al Jazeera, dancing to the tune of Israel like ballerinas. So start preparing babies for the struggle like Amina. In her infancy learning from my Marxist reader. Grandma said it doesn't sound like my Christian leaders. She's only one, so be mindful what you feed her. I replied ABC of Marxism, I start with them. Teach Leninism, socially with sharp vision. And organized youth undergoing harsh living. With no work, so make work, go and start prison. When they come home, Amina give them out with speech upon release. Organize them out with feast to build with communists far away from the streets and the lumpen who only ever knew defeat. That's the reason why they always running from police, mafia and blue elite who throw away the key. As time goes by, an eye for an eye. We in this together, so your struggle's mine. As long as Amina grows to age 25, get communist training on how to organize. As time goes by, an eye for an eye. We in this together, so your struggle's mine. As long as Amina grows to age 25, get communist training on how to organize.
Welcome back to After the Collapse. You heard Eye for an Eye by Comrade, and we're here with Steve De Silva. We've been talking about Basics News, which he is the former editor of, but still an active member.
People's journalist with. Yep.
I'm Louis Maroney, and as always, with Jim Vernon.
Just as we spoke for the break, maybe moving from the local level to the national and international level, you also, through your work at Basics, work with the May 1st movement and the ILPS, as we said at the start, and so maybe you could tell us a little bit about how the work you do at Basics connects with the work you do in terms of national and international solidarity movements.
Yeah, sure. So as I indicated from the beginning, our media organization developed hand-in-hand and alongside people's struggles in and around housing rights and against displacement and gentrification, around police brutality. And our organization has always developed and grown in relation to people's struggles developing and growing, because our paper serves as a concrete tool for people's struggles, and it's a venue to echo people's struggles. So that said, we obviously have huge stakes in developing a people's map, a media apparatus, also seeing the development of people's struggles broadly. And so we do concern ourselves and invest a lot of our time and resources into alliance work with people's struggles, into formalizing our relationships and developing a higher level of political unity with people who are fighting and struggling. And one of those examples is the May 1st movement, which came about, I believe, in 2008, 2009, when a number of organizations here in Toronto came together and decided it was time to take back and reclaim the day of May 1st as the day of International Workers' Day, as a day of struggle and resistance for working class people. As many people may know, you know, our official Labor Day is coming up. You know, it's a day of boozing, and if you're, you can get it together, you go parade and you march down to the exhibition place with all the unions. It's not really a day of struggle. It's a day for a bit of a parade and, you know, a bit of celebration. But it's been highly depoliticized by North America, you know, by Canada and the U.S. taking Labor Day and putting it, you know, for 4 or 5 months after the day when international workers all around the world are celebrating, fighting, in many cases, you know, waging very pitched battles and struggles for their rights and to advance their interests. You know, we saw it and we believed it to be necessary to struggle to reclaim this day. So our organization, along with about, fluctuated a little bit over the years, but give or take about a dozen organizations, have worked to try to build a militant and large rally on May 1st for the purposes of reclaiming May Day.
And how about the international League of People Struggles?
Yeah, so the ILPS is an international formation of mass organizations. So by mass organizations, I mean organizations that are democratic and have a mass character, which means they're not dictated or controlled by the state, agencies, NGOs, religious institutions, or political parties. They're actually run by people, and they're democratic in their character. So the ILPS has 300 to 400 organizations in pretty much all the continents. Our basis of unity, what we share in common, is we have an anti-imperialist basis of unity. And to join the ILPS, one only has to agree with one of 18 listed concerns, each of which has an anti-imperialist character to it. So what I mean by that is, you know, there's concerns for women's struggles, for the struggles of peasants and small farmers and fisher folk, for LGBTQ community, for students, for the aged, for around the cause of national liberation, around political prisoners and unjust, you know, detention, and the list goes on. I can't really recall them all. Media practitioners and researchers and journalists, there's all these concerns. And for each of those concerns, there's an anti-imperialist angle to why we do our work. And so any organization in the world, any mass organization, can join this international formation of struggle if they agree with the position in relation to their sector or to their particular issue or cause. So it formed in 2001 in Europe. I believe the first international assembly was somewhere in Europe. The second one was also in Europe. The third was in Hong Kong. And the fourth, which I had the you know, the great pleasure and incredible experience of being at, was in Manila, Philippines, last July 2011, which was attended by 450 people from, I think, 250 organizations around the world. So over the years, the ILPS has spawned a number of alliances that are more focused on their particular sectors of struggle or specific issues. So for instance, the International Women's Alliance, which was formed in 2008 at an international conference in Montreal. The International Migrants Alliance, which annually holds an international assembly of migrants and refugees in parallel to the United Nations International Forum on Development and Migration, which is this kind of neoliberal, you know, bonanza where they just talk about how, you know, we just need to promote more migration to promote development so people can send remittances home and, you know, we can exploit migrants and so on and so forth. So they've annually held these conferences next to the UN conference as a kind of parallel people's assembly. And a number of other initiatives have also come out of the International League of People Struggles. And us here in Canada, last year in May 2011, we founded the Canadian chapter of the ILPS with about 25 organizations, actually about 22 organizations, and particularly to consolidate our efforts in confronting, you know, imperialism as it exists here in Canada, which, you know, we believe the Canada itself to be an imperialist country. It takes a commanding position in the International Division of Labor, and you can assess that in a number of ways, whether it's you know, the nature of its capital, its finance, and, you know, other sections of capital, the way it exploits workers all around the world, the way it relies on, you know, migrant labor, increasingly precarious migrant labor, and also its relation to indigenous peoples and their own struggles for their territorial rights and land claims in this country. So we formed the Canadian chapter of the International People's Alliance in order to better coordinate our efforts in confronting capitalism, imperialism, and colonialism here in Canada.
So there's like a lot of different groups.
Yeah.
A lot of different people involved.
Yeah.
For the most part, aren't making much money.
Yeah, doing it's what they're people's doing. Organizations.
It's like a labor of
shoestring
love.
Budget, that's right.
How, A, hopeful, and B, effective, do you and people in these organizations believe you're being?
I'm 100% hopeful. If I have any hope whatsoever, it's in the independent initiative of the people, independent of the, you know, the status quo political parties, which I would kind of write off all of those parties in parliament right now as being just holding up the status quo in different ways. Whether it's organizations, you know, so much of what passes itself off in, say, in Toronto, but I'm much more broadly as well, as a community organization, is just this, you know, an agency relying on grants from foundations or from the government, where people come in with their dire and desperate situations, looking for assistance, and spaces which are completely devoid of any politics, where people cannot discuss their situations in any political way. So I take, for example, the article that came out in the Toronto Star about a week after the shootings in Danzig, where a whole bunch of so-called community organizations, all of them were agencies, you know, made this appeal for more funding, and why the violence in communities is a result of a lack of funding for social services, which could be keeping kids out of trouble and off the streets and so on and so forth. That was not a politically neutral statement on behalf of these agencies and social service provision organizations. As important as that is, you know, for example, just the mere provision of services, putting the violence, you know, putting the blame squarely back onto the communities that are being affected by the violence is not a, you know, it's a very political thing. I mean, it's very political to suggest that if you just give us more money, we'll solve the problems of violence amongst youth, when the guns and the drugs are not coming from these communities. They're coming from without. We don't know how. We have ideas. We know that there's much larger criminal syndicates that are involved, which are rarely discussed in the media. So for us, we believe that if political change is going to happen, it has to be at the initiative of people who are not kowtowing to, you know, some opportunistic political agenda or to career advance for some particular individuals at the head of the organization, but absolutely are driven by the independent autonomous initiative of people to fight for their freedom and liberation. They're not going to be sold out.
But somewhere within those organizations, the agencies that that are making these calls, they're has to be people in those agencies who are heartfelt and who actually believe they're making a change. Is there no place for these agencies, or is it just part of the picture?
I think there's in this our own context of a, you know, declining and you know a welfare state that is being stripped apart piece by piece by neoliberalism and austerity. We see organizations such as those, you know, service provision organizations and agencies, becoming increasingly precarious in their positions, because they are afraid that if they say anything, they're going to lose their funding, as with, you know, Canadian Arab Federation, the CAF, and I believe that ecumenical organization, Kairos, you know, a number of organizations who have lost their funding recently, and they believe because of the positions they've taken or because being outspoken advocates, increasingly the politics is being shut up, or, you know, people are being prevented or being gagged from speaking their minds if they want to receive money. And increasingly, even to receive funds, even to get funds as an organization, you have to actually sign up to an agenda that's set by the government. Whether it's, you know, I know that there's a set of funds coming down through the Liberal provincial government that says that if you want to take the funds, you have to work with police. And for those community organizations that for whom their clients or constituents are coming through the door and have serious problems with the police, that's only going to drive away those people. Or you look at the Canadian Citizenship and Immigration Canada and their provisions and their grants that, you know, they have these de-radicalization programs where, you know, if Muslim organizations want to receive funding, they have to do this de-radicalization stuff, which, you know, is kind of ambiguously defined and, you know, continues to propagate the stereotype of, you know, homegrown terrorism and Islamic extremism. But we're not being told exactly what de-radicalization is. I mean, this is a you know, the last few years have been radicalizing for a lot of people, and the government is giving money to organizations to de-radicalize people, you know. So I believe, you know, we should be fighting against the austerity offensive, and, you know, fighting to defend the services that many people rely on. But we also should have no illusions while doing that. And we also shouldn't assume that these organizations can be political spaces for struggle.
Is there any value to running for politics?
I don't believe in this, especially in this context, that electoral struggle could advance people's interests. I continuously see a lot of illusions around the potential for huge change through electoral struggle, whether it's electing one particular person who seems to have values that you share in a particular riding or constituency, or whether it's for a particular party. But yet people remain disorganized. People remain powerless and at the whim of this official that they've elected into office. And then after that election, they have no means to hold them to account. And the you know, the overwhelming power of the corporate media, you know, exercises a thousand times more force on dictating the positions that people end up taking once they're elected, however, you know, well-intentioned they may be. And so, you know, I think the elections have to be, if they're of any use whatsoever, and I have very little faith in elections, I think they have to be an instrument of an independent people's power that develops and grows and utilizes elections as a way to, you know, manifest the power that they've been able to develop. And I think there's examples all around the world where we can point to this, whether it's, you know, the people's movements in Venezuela, which continuously, you know, elect Chavez, whether it's, and many other examples in Latin America, where independent people's power has been able to register that power at the ballot box, but that power doesn't demobilize or go away once they've elected that person to power. And in fact, in many cases, even in the case of Chavez, people have had to fight to, you know, keep Chavez's feet to the fire, or Evo Morales's, or Correa of Ecuador's feet to the fire, and hold them to an agenda that serves the people and not the overwhelming pressure of imperialism, which wants to take those countries in a very different direction. So I think that's what's principal, is developing people's struggles to actually advance the cause of, you know, the fight for social justice and liberation.
So why don't we listen to another song?
Sure.
Can you just introduce this one for us?
Definitely. This is also off the Land Defenders for Life mixtape. The name of the track is Right to Rebel. You know, one of the slogans for the conference, track one of the conference particularly. It's also a track by Comrade. Hope you enjoy it. There's a lot of content in there that resonates with what we're trying to do. And if people are interested, the whole, the album itself, we're going to launch it officially at the concert that will conclude the conference on November 10th, which we've just recently heard. M1 from Dead Prez will also be performing it.
Okay, so here we go. Right to Rebel by Comrade.
Maybach music.
This is for all land defenders with attitude. Facing off greedy land developers mad at you. OPP handing out charges like cans of food. At the Daily Bread Food Bank, they have to prove. Six Nations are terrorists on the Wacker News. CTV, CBC, Global, lacking truth. April 28, Basics News, packing crews. Indie media, journalists who attract the view. Canada, respect treaty rights, don't act a fool. If you don't respect treaty rights, we attacking you. At the School of People's Journalism, packing truth. Come in peace, that don't work, bring back the troops. Native Youth Movement, Cis Native Saskatoon. Red Power Mohawk Warriors, that salute. And protect all living things, we have to choose. Life over death, Mother Earth, we backing you. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Workers have rights, Six Nations have rights. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Earth has a right to animals and plant life. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Workers have rights, Six Nations have rights. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Earth has a right to animals and plant life. Years back, the OG told me, little homie, choose your comrades slowly before they sold me to slavery. Rat infested hell grow moldy. No phones, walls have ears, move low key. Stay clear, armchair, radicals dead weight. One wrong move and imperialism checkmate. Internal opposition won through debate. External opposition done when you dig graves. Mass education for babies through hip hop. Advanced education for workers in big shops. One full day defending land in your lifetime. Learn more than 1,000 books at the right time. Sunrise to nighttime, go defend land. I'm sacrificing 4-7 generation lifelines. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Workers have rights, Six Nations have rights. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Earth has a right to animals and plant life. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Workers have rights, Six Nations have rights. It's right to rebel, we have the right to rebel. Earth has a right to animals and plant life.
Great. So, and can you explain how did this album get produced?
There's a group of progressive and revolutionary rappers from different communities that we're working with, particularly Comrade, who is a black activist here in Toronto, has done work for years, works closely with Basics. We have a number of Tamil rappers who were politicized through the genocide in Tamililam, and also some rappers from Six Nations.
So maybe you can tell us now about your upcoming conference in November.
Yeah, so the ILPS, the International League of People Struggles Canada, the Canadian chapter, is organizing this major conference for November, which we're calling Right to Exist, Right to Resist. This conference, we recognize that the economic system in which we live is making it increasingly difficult for people to exist. And for a long time, it's made it difficult for people to exist. So in this country, Indigenous people, for example, where Canada's agenda has always been some combination of assimilation or extermination. It really amounts to the same thing, eliminating Indigenous peoples as such. That's the most egregious and genocidal form of denying people the right to exist. But as the economic system spirals deeper and deeper into crisis, we see that, the state and the economy is attacking sections of the population which previously were, bulwarks of its support of keeping this country at peace. Maybe not a very peaceful peace, maybe a somewhat of a violent and socially conflictual peace. But I'm talking about the more secure sections of the working class, like the unionized workers, especially industrial public sector workers, which are now coming under attack in ways that we haven't seen in decades. We've really never seen before since the creation of the welfare state, where these sections of the working class, on the back of previous generations of class struggle, have been afforded a certain degree of stability, a stable and livable wage, a social wage to supplement that wage, a guarantee of security in old age with pensions and other benefits. This is all being unraveled. Unraveled as you know, both as a means to hold off and counter the economic crisis of that capitalism is experiencing right now, and because people are not mobilized to fight back. You know, in other parts of the world, especially in Europe, in Greece right now, we see people fighting and, you know, revolutionary movements mounting to combat the, you know, neoliberal globalization. In North America, we don't have that degree of mobilization and organization yet. And this is what we're looking to do with this conference, is unite all people's struggles in Canada. And that's pretty ambitious, eh? At least bring them together into a space where we can begin thinking about our struggles in relation to one another. So we have four tracks to the conference. We have the war on resistance, the war on workers, the war on communities, and the war on land defenders and the environment. And what we're looking to do is bring together different sections of the population, different sectors and communities into these different tracks to start having a conversation about how the war on resistance has affected them. So the war on resistance is how imperialism, how the Canadian state, as part of an imperialist world system, has attacked resistance movements, whether it's the inclusion of liberation organizations on the list of designated terrorist groups. So, for example, whether it's, you know, and I'll give a very ideologically varied range of groups, but I think groups that are, have some degree of, have a mass base and are fighting for some liberatory project with different kind of, you know, what that ultimately will look like, who knows. But whether it's Hezbollah or Hamas to the FARC in Colombia or the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine to the Communist Party of the Philippines to the Shining Path in Peru to the Tamil Tigers, you know, nationalist or communist or Islamic, you know, very ideologically different. But, you know, these groups all have social, they have massive bases of support. Or in the case of the Tamil Tigers, they had a massive base of support. And yet the Canadian government intervenes in a situation of international armed conflict and, you know, decidedly takes a side. Says, mm-hmm. No, we're going to side with Israel, one of the most, you know, pariah states in the world in terms of breaking international law, and says we are going to side with this state against virtually every political force in Palestine. And there's other forms that the war on resistance is taking, especially as the crisis goes deeper and deeper. With the G20, you know, law, what was it, Law 78 in Quebec, criminalizing the right of protest to students, and the criminalization of land defenders, indigenous people struggling to defend their land rights. Just an hour from here in Six Nations, dozens and dozens of people have been met with criminal charges. The second track of our conference, War on Workers, will be looking at the manifold ways in which capitalism is ratcheting up the exploitation and the precariousness of workers, whether it's, you know, the immigration passing a policy, the federal government passing a policy that, you know, now migrant workers can get paid 15% less than the rest of the working class, the minimum wage, or whether it's the criminalizing the right to strike for workers whenever a strike actually amounts to anything, mm-hmm. whenever it's not going to be a bunch of workers sitting in some far-flung, you know, factory where the company has a bunch of other plants and they don't need that factory. And, you know, when strikes matter, they're banned now. The war on communities is going to look at how working class communities are being attacked in the form of the mass incarceration agenda, police brutality, increasingly precarious situations, poverty, the war on drugs, and war on land defenders will look at those people who are beginning to struggle or have been struggling against the dispossession of their land and their territory and the environment. So whether it's indigenous land defenders to communities fighting against Canadian mining companies all around the world, to environmentalists. You know. So we're looking to bring these people together and begin strategizing on how to actually build, and this is the big objective of the conference, how to build a united front of our forces against Canadian imperialism, colonialism, and capitalism.
So can you tell us where listeners might turn to information about basics, about ILPS, about the conference, about the May 1st movement?
Definitely. I mean, you can find all those things off our own website, basicsnews.ca. If you want to get more information about the conference in particular, you can find that on the right-hand side of our website. You can link it from there. The ILPS website is ilps-canada.ca. And the international section is ilps.info. And, you know, we welcome people to check out our website. We have regular features, analyses, our radio shows, videos, photography, links to events and things that we're doing.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Steve Da Silva. You've been listening to After the Collapse on Radio Regent with Jim Vernon and Louis Maroney. And again, thank you. And
thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much.
Again, that was our interview with Steve Da Silva, co-founder of Basics News and current co-chair of the Canadian branch of the International League of People's Struggle. For more information on these organizations and other important movements we cover on After the Collapse, please follow us on Twitter at Collapse Radio and learn more about us at facebook.com/afterthecollapse. We air on radioregent.com. I am Louis Maroney and happy to co-host this program with Jim Vernon. Here is Steve Da Silva's last song pick, Land Defenders by James Blood of True Res, featuring Big Z and Fresh Wes. Frankie D on the edge, rip that shit the fuck up. True Res, Land Defenders. Why sound what up? Live from Six Nations with a warrior's bill, warrior skills, time to go in for the kill. Look, homie, I only roll with the drill. They sending in troops, cold with the steel. Bring it. Known for holding it down and we holding it still. Home of the ill, it's the Six Nays Zoo. And the animals run this motherfucker. Survival instincts, evil hustling a chinging motherfucker. I'm like the grand chief stepping to these politicians, threatening a way of living with this devilish system. My rebel division, battling its hell that's arisen. They tearing down schools and rebuilding prisons. Filling them with Latins, blacks, ninjas to conquer and divide the youth religion. Look what's left in the end, but we'll never die. Fight the power, red fist rise and hit them again. Bang! Addiction got my brother and my own fucking cousins. I'm sickened, cause those are the people that I be loving. I don't get it. Will I be next? Become a skinny prick who always gives out sex? I guess the best way for me is to stay out of it. We've all been handed it, I wouldn't put a doubt on it. I'm scared for them hard to the core, but as hard as they all still poor. Body evacuation, druggie assassination, destroying our nation as the youth be waiting. And finally saying, I think we should try. But in the end, they didn't realize that they would die. Cry, cry, cry. Did all of the families imagine it? How would you be handling? Have some empathy. Look at me, I don't have sympathy. I'm just giving you the truth. It's the best form of energy. Yo, my people struggle with the spiritual, mental, and physical. From first contact, they've been trying to make us individual, separate from the earth. But we know that ain't the case, cause we know that the search can be traced to the state. Mindset, making new snowshoes and rules. Follow from the heart, chart the stars and navigate moves. Made our way across the tundra and found our homes. Been displaced and disgraced, and now while we roam. It was foretold, prophecies written on scrolls of how this great change would come as a new people arose. We traded birth for guns, sons and daughters received the language of thieves. Believed in things like evil, became ashamed of our people. Our eagle feathers were taken, and now they lie in basements of museums where no one can see them. Kinda like our freedom hidden from the world stage. Can they understand our pain when a fence is put up, or another lake is drained? I feel the veins slice, blood of a mother that sustains life. Father sky, give me strength so I can be right. I wanna walk in beauty now, so they gotta let me shine. And I do it with this positive mind, so watch me grind.